Science Friday is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Science Friday is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. That's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, coming to you today from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Later this hour, the chemistry and light tricks that bring us the rainbow, the science of colors. But first, one of the scientific advances that's taken the biology world by storm is the gene editing technique known as CRISPR. It allows researchers to fairly easily make edits to genes, snipping out one sequence, inserting another in its place. But it appears there could be a downside to the technique. Joining me now to talk about it is Sharon Begley. She's senior science writer at Stat News, based in Boston, and author of an article this week about new research findings in the CRISPR world. Welcome back to the program, Sharon.
Thank you for having me, Ira.
So tell us about this. What exactly did these research papers find?
These were two papers published earlier this week in the journal Nature Medicine, and they both converged on a similar conclusion. Both used CRISPR, which, as you described, is the latest genome editing technique, to alter cells. One group used stem cells. The other group used eye cells, both human. And they found that it was much easier to CRISPR the cells, but we're now using CRISPR as a verb, if those cells lacked a key anti-cancer gene and anti-cancer pathway. So to flip that around, if cells are successfully edited, if their genomes are successfully edited with CRISPR, that raises a concern that maybe there's something wrong with those cells, i.e. that they lack a crucial anti-cancer pathway. So that's all that the studies did. They didn't find that anybody was going to get cancer from CRISPR, but they raised this as a red flag.
So does that give CRISPR sort of a black eye then?
Well, you know, a lot of people on Wall Street thought so. After the story and the research papers came out, the stocks of the three pure CRISPR companies took a dive in the sort of 8%, 13% range. So that got a lot of people upset. But it is absolutely not the case that CRISPR is toast. This is only a preliminary finding, but it's an important one. I mean, you know, let's look at this. This is a very new technology. It has surged ahead, as you described, because it's so easy to use and holds so much promise. So this is like a little bit of a go slow sign that the two groups of researchers, and I want to emphasize that, the two independent teams of scientists, one at Novartis, the drug company, the other at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, again, both converging on the same conclusion, holding up a go slow sign, and they both reached a very similar recommendation, namely, as scientists, as companies continue to develop CRISPR to use to treat diseases, you know what? You better start looking at those cells to see if they might have lost their anti-cancer mechanisms.
And now I know this study involves one variant called CRISPR-Cas9, which is the one most of us have heard about. Now, there are other CRISPR variants, correct? Have those been studied, and would we expect the same results?
There are more CRISPR variants than there are flavors of cupcakes at your local bakery. So there are other CRISPR variants, indeed.
I love cupcakes.
Well, there you go. And I suppose you like many flavors of cupcakes, as do I. Yes. So that's where we are in CRISPR land at the moment. Anyway, Cas9 is one of the cutting enzymes. It cuts out sequences of DNA. But yes, just as you said, there are other cutting enzymes. But more crucially, there's a form of CRISPR that was developed about 2 years ago out of a Harvard lab, which doesn't cut the double-stranded DNA. Instead of cutting it and then inserting a repair gene, which is the sort of common idea for many of the CRISPR therapeutic companies, this form of CRISPR, which is called base editing, makes just a single change in the DNA. And it has been likened to, instead of using scissors, using a pencil, an eraser and a pencil, changing one of the DNA letters to another. And in many cases, just that single base pair, that single nucleotide, is the reason for a devastating genetic disease. So again, this is called base editing. A company, of course, has been just launched to develop it. So yes, there are many forms of CRISPR, and the two studies that we're talking about looked at only the traditional, original CRISPR-Cas9 version.
Since we're sort of talking about engineering here, I mean, could you not think that, well, maybe we can make a form of CRISPR that would skip a cell with the bad gene P53 in it, and I'm going to skip it, you know.
Yes, and that's what the two teams of scientists called for. They said both screen your cells to be sure that their P53 mechanism is intact. Once you have successfully edited their genomes with CRISPR, or really with anything else, screen them again to be sure that there is no problem there. But, you know, Ira, there's another thing to consider here. For many of the diseases that scientists, both in academia and in industry, are thinking about, hoping to use CRISPR to treat, those are devastating diseases that are going to kill people in many cases in just a few years. Cancer typically takes decades, even 20 years, 30 years to develop. So even if this turns out to be a real problem, it could very well be that the risk-benefit calculation says, you know what, help these people today because they will live for another few decades, and then if they get cancer, they will at least have had those years of life, and many forms of cancer are treatable. It's sort of like little children who get cancer. They're treated with radiation, they're treated with very powerful therapies, and unfortunately many of them develop cancer when they are adults, but those children have lived for another 20 or 30 years. Worst case, that's what will happen with CRISPR, but it will still be hugely valuable to many patients.
And who knows what might be, invented in those years to cure the cancers or stuff that they might get decades from now.
Exactly.
Yeah. So how different, let's talk about CRISPR a bit. How different is this from quote unquote traditional gene therapy that might have been done in the 1990s?
In fact, that was done in 1990. That was the first gene therapy experiment in this country. Mm-hmm. So traditional gene therapy takes a so-called vector, usually a virus, which is just a delivery vehicle. It packs the healthy gene into that virus, and it sends the virus into cells, either inside a patient or cells that have been taken out of a patient to be returned to the patient eventually. And the idea is that when a patient has lots of copies of the healthy gene, that healthy gene will cure whatever the disease happens to be. The 1990 gene therapy trial was in so-called bubble boy disease, ADA deficiency. And the reason that was so difficult, and 1990 was a long time ago, and since then we have had only a single gene therapy approved by the FDA, is that packing genes into viruses is a very hard thing to do. Genes are big. Many of them are hundreds, if not thousands, of base pairs long. Where the virus goes inside the cell's genome, is a flip of the coin. In fact, in one gene therapy trial in France, unfortunately, the viruses landed next to a cancer-promoting gene, and those children developed leukemia. Mm. Where CRISPR has it all over the traditional gene therapy, it doesn't pack the entire gene into the vector, into the virus. All it does is include the molecular scissors that we talked about earlier that cuts the genome, usually a little repair part, but it's only a few letters long. You're not replacing the entire gene. You're only replacing the part that is misspelled. And that's what makes it so much easier. And that's why all of the hopes are as high as they are. It's easier to use. It's more precise. It's more controllable. Yeah. And, people just think the sky's the limit.
Well, speaking of that, are we still, though, is CRISPR still a lab curiosity, or are there companies actively using it, and is it in trial? Trials anyway.
There are indeed three main companies that formed, publicly traded companies that formed to develop CRISPR-based therapeutics, Editas Medicine, CRISPR Therapeutics, and Intellia. And the furthest along in terms of clinical trials is Editas Medicine. It has announced that this year, 2018, it will launch a clinical trial using CRISPR to treat a form of congenital inherited blindness. It's called Leber's congenital blindness. So it's really moving along. And remember, Ira, that the key steps in making CRISPR, you know, workable as a genome editor was in early 2013. So this has just rocketed from a lab curiosity, at least a lab development, into human clinical trials this year.
Yes, and as you say, even though the stock in these companies have suffered, this is probably just a temporary setback.
And as you said, it's not something that seems impossible to engineer around. It could be that the therapy, even if there is a cancer risk, is still so of such great benefit to patients that, you know, the cancer risk down the road is something that they will deal with. But crucially, because there are other forms of CRISPR than the traditional CRISPR-Cas9, this seems more like, you know, a bump in the road, something that researchers are going to have to pay attention to, but in no way is it, you know, shutting down the entire prospects.
Oh, so as you're saying, they're like CRISPR-Cas13 or whatever, now could get a boost for research.
Well, see, now you are tiptoeing into the very fraught topic of the patent landscape around CRISPR, which,
it's always patents,
Lord willing,
isn't it?
We will avoid. But, you know, there are all sorts of different entities who hold patents on the different CRISPR enzymes, various permutations and combinations of how they are used. So how all that shakes out very much remains to be seen.
So it's always all about the money. Isn't it, when we talk about medicine?
You said it, not me.
But I know I've followed your career for almost as long as I've been doing, probably longer, and you really do focus on the business side of medicine a lot. I know that.
Well, because, you know, say what one will about pharma or biotech, these therapies are not going anywhere. They're not leaving, you know, mice and C. elegans and Drosophila unless some company decides that there's a profit motive to be made here. So as long as we live in that kind of system, yes, that's how it works.
And I'm glad to have you around, Sharon, to keep us
straight.
Thank
you, Ira.
You're welcome. Sharon Begley, senior science writer at the Stat News, based in Boston, Massachusetts. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about color. Everything you ever wanted to know about color. Surprising stuff. You thought you knew about color, but we're wrong. You'll be right when we come back. So stay with us. We'll talk everything about it. You can also give us a call, 844-724-8255, if you're wondering about color. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I promised you before the break we would talk about color and things you thought you knew about color. All right, here's the first stuff that we're going to throw at you. Peacock feathers, blue morpho butterflies, and blue human eyes. Besides their color, they have one thing in common. What is that? They are not actually blue. That is, they don't contain any blue pigment. Molecules that reflect blue light the way a paint or a dye works. Did you know that? Well, now you do. How do we look at them and see blue then? It's a trick. Tiny shapes, too small to see, bounce and bend white light. They break it up and send back only the blue. Okay, here's another one for you. Red pigment. Did you know it's harder than you think and usually either less stable or requires toxic chemical elements to achieve the perfect hue for, say, painting a Ferrari? And throughout history, artists and chemists have worked hard to make pigments that pop and can stand the test of time. But What gives us that hue in the first place? Pure physics, the jumping of electrons, the absorption and emission of energy, and the arrangement of atoms inside molecules that makes all of this happen, and that's what we're going to talk about. Everything you wanted to know about color. Here to talk about color and the invisible processes that bring it out to your eyeballs are my guests. Let me introduce you to Masubramanian, professor of material science at Oregon State University. He joins us by Skype from Corvallis. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, Ira. Thanks for having me on the program.
It's our pleasure. Andrew Parker, research fellow at Oxford University's Green Templeton College and author of Seven Deadly Colors. He joins us from London. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Mas, let me start with you. I'll start with a simple question, though. Maybe the answer isn't so simple. How do we look at a painting? We see all those different colors. What is going on between what's in the paint, the matter of the paint, and our eyes?
A pigment or a dye, which is used in the painting, is a colorant material that actually reflects the light, part of the light which is not absorbed in the visible range. So whenever you see a color, they all come from selective wavelength absorption.
So you're saying that if white light, let's say, falls on the painting, it absorbs all the colors of that white light except, let's say, if it's red on the paint, and that's what reflects to our eyes?
Exactly.
Huh. And Andrew, but not every color we see in nature comes from a pigment, right? Especially blue. Give us an example of a blue jay's feathers, blue eyes, or butterfly wings. Those are not pigments, right?
That's right. Actually, they're some of the brightest colors that exist in nature, but they are made from completely transparent materials. These are materials that have structure to them, well, microscopic structure. When you look at them in an electron microscope, you can see that there are all sorts of architectures in there, almost like tiny buildings. And light comes in and bounces and reflects and refracts. And again, some of the wavelengths pass through, and so you don't actually see those. And other wavelengths are actually reflected. You get constructive interference for those. And so that's the color that you see.
And why is blue involved in so many of these things?
Yeah, that's a good question. We've been working on that for a while. The one interesting thing is that when a structural color, these colors made from structures, they tend to be quite a large range of wavelengths with a peak in the middle. And quite often you see the color of that peak plus the bits either side of it. Well, blue is actually next to ultraviolet in the spectrum. So you can actually have your range of wavelengths in the ultraviolet and the blue. So you only see blue and ultraviolet. Well, we don't see ultraviolet, so we just get the blue. If you did that in the green, for example, you'd also get a bit of yellow and a bit of blue. So it doesn't quite work as well for other colors. So blue is the handiest. But also, there's an option to make reds, greens, and yellows from pigments, much more than there is for blues in nature. Hmm.
Interesting. Mas, I know that 10 years ago you were looking for semiconductors, and then you found a brand new blue pigment instead. How does that happen?
Well, in 2009, we are doing some research that focused on the discovery of some exotic material that we thought will be useful in electronics, such as computers. In fact, the project was nothing to do with the discovery of a colored pigment. So we made a series of compounds, which are oxides of three elements, yttrium, indium, and manganese, and we heated them to high temperatures and studied their magnetic properties. Next day, when I was in the lab, the student picked up the sample, it all came brilliantly blue. It is very, very vivid blue, just like what we see in morpho butterflies. I was really shocked because these elements are not supposed to make a blue pigment or blue materials, because manganese oxides normally form black or brown. Hmm. So I thought we made some mistakes, and then we repeated the experiment, and then we could reproduce it. Then after studying the crystal structure of this material, we found this manganese is situated in a very unusual surroundings or coordination that seems to act as a chromophore and absorbs in the orange region, giving rise to this vivid blue color. So and it was very stable because we heated this to very high temperatures, like 1,200 degrees Celsius or about 2,200 degrees Fahrenheit. So it definitely is very stable. And also it is very stable to water, oil, or acid and alkali. So then I thought immediately that it can be a very good pig blue pigment. I know it is hard to make.
Speaking of hard to make, I know that you're looking for red now. Why is red so difficult?
Well, historically, the red pigments always contain some toxic elements like cadmium, you know the cadmium sulfide, cadmium selenide, which forms what we call solid solution, which creates the cadmium red pigments. And they are not very stable to high temperatures. And also, they have the toxicity issues, which cadmium is toxic, it's a carcinogen. Same thing with the mercury sulfide, which we call vermilion, which contain mercury and sulfur, also gives rise to a very vivid red color. But unfortunately, mercury is toxic. So if you look at all these materials, they are all color come from electronic structure of the material, and they are semiconductors.
But my question, I can go, I can have my crayons, or I can go to the paint store and tell them, hey, make me red. They don't have any problem with that. Why are you surprised that you can or find such difficulty in making red?
Because most of the red pigments are dyes used in crayons or in paints, mostly based on organics. And they are not as stable as the inorganic pigments like the one I discussed about. So if I can make a very highly stable red pigment, which is durable and very stable, non-toxic, there is a lot of other applications like outdoor paintings. You don't see that much red painting outdoors because they can really fade under the UV light or under the sun. So there is always a lot of demand for highly stable, durable, inorganic pigment in the paint industry.
That's why the car people want it. They're going to be sitting out in the sun all the time. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Pittsburgh. Let's go to Austin in Pittsburgh. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, go ahead.
So I had a question about if you had a piece of paper that had red ink versus black ink, what is it about the molecules in the ink that allow them to absorb certain wavelengths versus reflecting certain wavelengths? And do those wavelengths that get absorbed and reflected correspond to molecular vibrations at the atomic level?
Andrew, can you answer that?
Well, actually, so this is really a question of pigments, and it's about the energy, the amount of energy that can be absorbed. So when the pigment eats up the energy coming from the light, it causes electrons to jump around the molecule. So it leaps from atom to atom around the outside of the molecule. And as it does, it loses a little bit of energy as heat and eventually gets eaten up. So it's just the characteristic of those particular molecules and the atomic and molecular arrangement that allows some to eat up quite a lot of energy and some a little less so.
In the case of the red, for example, the pigment, which is maybe organic, maybe due to the what you call charge transfer, a charge transfer from one molecule to the other molecule in the organic compound. Same thing can happen in inorganic too. Same thing with black. A black pigment is made when all the wavelength get absorbed. It's just opposite to white, which reflects all the colors. So the color in any pigment come from various mechanisms. It can be a semiconducting mechanism, just like in a red pigment, or it can be a charge transfer, or it can be what you call as electron transitions in a transition metal elements, like nickel, copper, manganese. So there are several mechanisms. That's why it is very difficult to predict the color of the compound you make it in the lab. You can't design a color. It's very hard to design a material which will have a particular color because there are so many different ways the color can happen, and also so many different ways the color can be destroyed because you may have a defects, non-stoichiometry, and so on.
Let's talk about one of my favorite subjects, and that is rainbows. The LETS light that's refracted and bent and let's talk about how light enters at sunlight enters the raindrops, that it has to be a certain angle, refracted, bent out. Andrew, tell us how a rainbow is able to produce all those colors.
Okay, well, what you see a rainbow when the sun is behind you and you're looking into rain. And what happens is each of those raindrops acts as a tiny prism. So the sunlight enters the raindrop, and it bounces off the far surface and comes back out towards you. But the refractive index of water is slightly different to air, and it causes the white light to split slightly. So each color diverts slightly into a different angle. And that spreads it out into a spectrum, just like you see coming from a prism.
So if I'm standing 20 feet away from a person, I'm seeing the light coming from different raindrops than that other person is. So am I, in effect, seeing a different rainbow?
Yes, that's right. The rainbow is in a slightly different position.
So we each have our own rainbow that we're looking at.
Yeah, absolutely, which means there's no end to it, unfortunately.
Well, actually, if you see a rainbow from an airplane, which I have seen, it's circular. It doesn't end anywhere.
That's true. Yes, absolutely. Because then you are you're looking onto at rain from all directions. So when we are looking at rain against the horizon, we only see from the horizon upwards. So we only see half the circle.
Let's go to the phones. To Richard in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Ira. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi. Go ahead.
I have a quick question. I'm basing this on a Wikipedia article I read a while back. The article said or seemed to suggest that purple is a manufactured color, but violet isn't. It's a natural color, and that violet can't be manufactured. Can Andrew explain that?
Well, okay,
let me remind everybody first, Andrew, that if I might interrupt, this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Go ahead. What about this? Is it true that violet cannot be manufactured, Andrew?
Well, so violet is one of the colors in the spectrum, one of the seven or six colors, whichever you prefer, and so it can't be broken down any further. It's a pure color, whereas purple is actually a mixture of two of the colors in the spectrum. It's a mixture of red and blue. And you sometimes get this occurring naturally in structural colors where we have a primary spectrum being reflected, and you'll also get secondary spectra. And the start and the end of each of those spectra can sometimes overlap. So you can get blue and violet overlapping, which will cause the purple color. And you do see this in nature. You do see purple feathers, for example, that are caused by that overlapping.
Mas, let me ask you about something I mentioned earlier on, and that was interesting news or interesting ideas about gemstones. Aren't rubies very closely related to a transparent, colorless crystal?
The ruby is made by substituting small amount of chromium in a corundum structure, which is nothing but aluminum oxide. So when you put small amount of chromium, it creates the electronic transitions, the electronic jump from one level to the other level. Then you create this absorption in the blue region and gives rise to this brilliant red color. And the interesting thing about the emerald, even if you have a chromium, it never produces red color. In the case of emerald, for example, when you substitute chromium in another structure which is similar to corundum, you get a green color. So it is very hard to tell. Always the chromium will give rise to the blue color or a red color, or sometimes just a green color. So that's why it's difficult to predict the color of the compound. You make it in the lab and test the crystal structure and see where the color come from.
Is it true that I heard that water is slightly blue? I mean, natural. We went about the deep blue sea, but water has a blue tinge to it?
Yes, it is very true. Unlike sky, which comes from the scattering, like a Rayleigh scattering, water is inherently blue. When water in small quantities, it appears colorless to the human eye. It is easy to see a blueness of the water in sufficiently deep oceans or in lakes like a crater lake in Oregon or in glaciers. The blueness of the water is not due to the reflection from the sky as we always think about. It is actually due to the vibrations of water molecules, because water is a bent molecule. They undergo three kinds of vibrations, and these vibrations create what you call overtones, just like in music. Wow. So that absorbs near the red region, giving rise to this pale blue color to the water. But if you have a, instead of a normal water, if you have a heavy water, like a D2O or deuterium, substituted for the hydrogen, the water becomes colorless because now it absorbs in the far infrared region.
That so, is that's fascinating. Hank, save it for the break, because we have to take a break, and you sound like you have something great you want to tell us. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more about colors. Our number 844-724-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. We're talking about colors and all the different things you didn't know about colors, which I certainly do. We're talking with Masa Brahmanian, professor of material science at Oregon State University, Andrew Parker, research fellow at Oxford University's Green Templeton College, author of Seven Deadly Colors, and he's in London. And before I rudely interrupted you, Masa, you were going to tell us something fantastic.
Well, what I wanted to say was, if the water didn't have any hydrogen bonding, that is the bonding between hydrogen and oxygen from one molecule to the other molecule, the water will be even more intense blue. So we'll be drinking blue water and taking showers with blue water. But because of this hydrogen bonding, we shift the absorption towards near infrared, so that makes the blue color more paler and difficult to see.
Does that mean we could find water that's different than hydrogen bonding?
It's harder to do, because whenever you have a hydrogen and oxygen, because one has got a highly electronegative, other one has got electropositive, they try to form a bond, which creates what you call a weak bond. That weak bond is called hydrogen bond. So it's very hard to do it. But somehow I feel like maybe it will exist in the future, but now right now I don't have any example which shows water like a water which can show a deep blue color. Actually,
let me go to the phones. 844-724-8255. Let's go to Orlando. Kathy, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi
there, go ahead.
Hey, I wanted to give a fact about vision, and that's that several types of animals, including birds and some insects, can see ultraviolet, and therefore they see like millions more colors than we can see.
Yes, that is true.
Andrew, what do you
That's
say
right.
about that?
Yeah, Andrew. No, absolutely. No, there's we have quite a good range of vision, actually, going from violet to red. That's 400 to 700 nanometers. But just beyond the violet, that you've got a range of ultraviolet from about 360 to 400 nanometers. And lots of animals do see that. In fact, most insects and birds and even a lot of fish and amphibians. So there is a part of the world that we just don't know what's going on. There's insects are finding flowers and birds are finding insects. And we have absolutely no idea how they're doing it, because we can't see those private ultraviolet signals that are all around us.
You know,
can I add something to it?
Sure. Sure.
You know, I'm sure Andrew knows about this. There is a crustacean called mantis shrimp, which has got, I heard, about 11 or 13 cones, where we only have 3 cones in our eyes. So it can show, it can see more wavelength than humans can do. So definitely there are animals which exist which can see better than us or more than us.
That's right. Well, the mantis shrimp can distinguish colors more accurately than us. Now, but interestingly, that's a marine animal. And in the sea, we've just been talking about blue, and blue is the color that transmits best through water. And as such, eyes evolved in the deeper sea to see only blue light. And in fact, some animals, like mammals, they, in evolutionary history, they went into deep water where only blue light from sunlight exists. All the other colors don't make it that far. And so they evolved eyes that only see blue. And when they came back up to the surface in evolutionary time, they couldn't re-evolve those other receptors. So now they're stuck with effectively black and white vision.
That's fascinating.
But there's also the other interesting thing about that deep sea, because it's only blue, most animals there living there are either red or black. And now red won't reflect any of that blue light. So anything that's red will be totally camouflaged until that is the dragonfish evolved. So a dragonfish evolved red bioluminescent lights and a red color receptor in its eyes. So it goes around now shining red lights all around the deep sea and catches out all those animals that would otherwise be totally camouflaged in that region. And it just has a free-for-all, effectively. It can just see everything. It can see all those different prey, all those little shrimps and tiny fish.
That's really fascinating. That's fascinating. I didn't know that. Maslam, in the short time I have left, I want to ask you this. You were talking about the difficulty of making certain pigments without toxic chemicals before. Why can't artificial intelligence help us predict which combinations might get some of these sought-after pigments? You know, we use them for all these things. Isn't there a computer model that'll say, yes, this color will pop out if you mix this stuff?
Well, that is an interesting question. In fact, there are lots of computer scientists who are trying to model how to create compound with their desired properties, just like a color or electronic properties and so on. It is not easy to do it because sometimes they create materials which are stable only in computers, not in furnaces. So it's very hard to it's very hard to make them in the lab. That's why the Enmin blue it was never predicted before, although the companies are looking for a new blue pigment for hundreds of years. The last blue pigment discovered was cobalt blue, which was 1802. So it's not easy to predict them, but you can try to rationalize them and say some intuitively or some chemistry principles. You can try to kind of a trial and error is still important in creating these, making the discoveries. That's why most of the pigments were discovered by accident, just like a Prussian blue is another example.
All right. That's a great way to end. I can't think of a better way to end our segment. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Master Brahmamanian is a professor of material science at Oregon State University, and he joined us by Skype. And Andrew Parker, research fellow at Oxford University's Green Templeton College and author of 7 Deadly Colors. And you can see photos of some of the phenomena we discussed on our website at sciencefriday.com/color. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Okay, I want you to listen carefully. Can you ID this sound? No, that's not the clock from 60 Minutes at the beginning of the show. This is the sound of a narwhal. The ocean is filled with fascinating sea creatures, and the narwhal is one that seems to capture the imagination of a lot of people. It kind of looks like a beluga whale, but it has that long horn. And narwhals are pretty elusive. There aren't any in captivity, and not much is known about the whales. Let's let people's imagination run wild. Boy, They call them unicorns of the sea because they think they are when they see one. Scientists are interested in them, too, and a team of researchers tagged 6 narwhals with acoustic tags to create a sort of narwhal audio diary. And the results were published this week in the journal PLOS ONE. My next guest is one of the authors on that study. Susanna Blackwell is a biologist, senior scientist at Greenridge Sciences based in Santa Barbara. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Now, is it true that narwhals live only in the Arctic?
Yes, not in the Antarctic, as many people ask me.
Oh, and so we know that that area is rapidly changing. Does that mean the narwhals are going to be affected also?
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out. We know that right now they have a couple of potential issues facing them. One is the fact that the waters are getting warmer, and there's less ice in the summer, and so their environment their environment is changing. The other is that because of that change, because of the lack of ice in the summer, there is a potential human activities that may come and take place. So there's going to be a change in the sound of their environment too.
What do they depend on to live in the Arctic? Is it the ice that's there?
Well, it's not really well known. They seem to be very linked to the pack ice. Like in the winter, you would think, well, maybe they could go south where there is no pack ice, yet all winter long they remain in the pack ice, in very dense ice, where they dive to great depths and, you know, forage for fish and stuff.
Mm-hmm. I know you attach tags that can record audio to 6 different narwhals to get a sense of what kind of sounds they're making, and we have some of those sounds here. Let's hear some of the sounds you recorded. Let's play this clip first. Wow. I've sounds almost like Weddell seals at some point. It's like all kinds of diving sounds. Tell us what we were listening to.
Yeah, so that's actually one of my favorite clips. It occurred very close to the surface, and it involved several narwhals. We don't really know how many, but we definitely know there were more than just the animal that was carrying the tag. I wish I spoke narwhal. I wish I knew what they were saying. And you listen to the clip, you can hear all kinds of different sounds, whistles and burst pulses and squeaky sounds and such. But so it's a form of communication. We think that much is for sure. But what they're saying, we don't know.
Yeah. And after the narwhals were tagged and released, they didn't make any sounds for almost up to a full day, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think they were frazzled by, you know, to instrument them, we have to catch them in a net. And they are actually animals that are hunted in the Arctic by the natives. So they may have thought their last moment had come. I don't know. In any event, we remove them from the net and put the tags on and then release them. So it's interesting to see that they don't just go straight back to behaving normally. They actually were silent for anything between 9 and 35 hours or so, 23 hours on average, before they started echolocating and seemingly behaving normally.
I'm Ira Flatto. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Talking with Susanna Blackwell about her narwhal research. And we have a really interesting question on phones, so let's go to the phones. Let's go to Berkeley. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there. I'm very interested in ocean issues and ocean subjects. A lot has come out about narwhals' tusks and how they're used in perceiving the world around them. And I was wondering if there was any correlation between their horn and sound production and reception.
Well, in these first 6 animals that we instrumented, only one of them was a male. And at this point, we have not looked at any of those questions. So that may be something for the future. I'm not sure. But, you know, there are several thoughts on what the tusk is for. And I think our group tends to believe that it's a secondary sexual characteristics more than an environment sensing organ. And one reason for that is that if it was important for survival, then why do the girls not have it, right? The female narwhal seems to do just fine without the tusk.
What is the tusk part of? Is it? It's not like a horn, is it?
No, it's actually one of the front tooth. One of the front teeth. Sorry, it's the left one. In fact, in the skull, you can find the right one, which is small and just remains inside the skull, and the left one at some point in males starts to erupt. Although I have to say, sometimes there are females with tusks, and sometimes there are males without. So it's not, you know, it's not completely absolute. But we actually use the tusk to determine whether it's a male or a female. Otherwise, we'd have to flip the whale upside down and whatnot. We don't want to do that. So we just say if it has a tusk, it's a boy. If it does not, it's a girl.
Yeah, I hate it when that happens. You know, have to flip it upside down. So what's the next step in your study? You've now tagged them. What would you really want to know? What is the bottom line that you want to know?
Well, this first paper was really sort of just one step in the way. What we really are interested in is the effects of air gun pulses on the animals. And air gun pulses are used in seismic exploration to look for oil and gas. And they are fairly high amplitude sounds. And there's a lot of interest by various oil companies in prospecting around Greenland. And east and west of Greenland is basically where most of the narwhals of the world hang out. And, of course, we feel like it's really important to know what the effects of these sounds are on this animal, which is really pretty poorly known.
Yeah, so you see, the big question, big picture question, is how the narwhals might be affected by human-made sound.
And yes.
Do you have any preliminary data that how do you think they might respond?
Well, we only know that when people do vessel-based surveys, you know, when they go out and count the marine mammals, narwhals are very rarely seen, even when those vessels go through areas where aerial surveys have shown that there are thousands of whales.
Yeah.
And so they are very sensitive. They seem to be very sensitive to underwater sound.
I have only about a minute left, so I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm always interested in how scientists get into their line of work and what motivates you. How did you get interested in narwhals, of all things?
Well, you know, I actually never thought I would be working on narwhals. It's sort of this quasi-mythical animal, even for marine mammal biologists. But I worked on bowheads for many years and studied the effects of air gun pulses on bowheads. And then I just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And a team of Danes had been doing work for many years in Greenland, and they needed somebody who understood acoustics. And I had worked on the effects of air gun pulses, and so there you go. This just happened.
Yeah. Isn't life like that a lot? You happen to be in the right place at the right time?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And so you're going to stick with this for a while, I'm hoping.
As long as I can.
Yeah, right. And as long as you get new information, we're always happy to have you back, Dr. Blackwell.
Oh, thank you very much.
Come back and talk to us. Susanna Blackwell is a biologist and senior scientist at the Greenridge Sciences based in Santa Barbara. And you can hear more of those narwhal sounds. They're really fascinating. At our website, it's sciencefriday.com/narwhal. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. And if you missed any part of the show, you'd like to hear it again, you know, you can always subscribe to our podcast. Take your podcast of, you know, player of choice. And you can always ask your smart speaker now to add, I won't say the name of the speaker, to play Science Friday whenever you want. So, you know, every day now is Science Friday. And we're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all over the place. We want to thank the folks at WBEZ again for hosting us this week on Science Friday. We'll be back in New York next week and hope to see you then. I'm Ira Flatow in Chicago.